Good evening. And I have to thank Ken Quiet Hawk for that lovely introduction. He was a little creative at the end there, but I guess that's okay when you consider his voice is so amazing. I hope you are ready for an amazing show tonight, because I certainly am. I have a spectacular guest. So button up, buckle up. It's going to be a very interesting show. Her name is Paola Harris, and she is an amazing lady. She is what I have to call, in today's time when there is so much fake news and everything out there, and reporters are trying to tell you what to think instead of giving you the facts, she is the only sincere, honest, pure journalist that I think is out there. She's an Italian-American photojournalist and investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena research. She's also a widely published freelance writer, especially in Europe. She studied extraterrestrial-related phenomena since 1979 and is on personal terms with many of the leading researchers in the field. From 1980 to 1986, she assisted Dr. J. Allen Hynek with his UFO investigations and has interviewed many top military and witnesses concerning their involvement in the government truth embargo. In 1997, she met and interviewed Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell, New Mexico, and became a personal friend and confidant. She was instrumental in having his book, The Day After Roswell, for which she wrote the preface, translated into Italian. She's written many books, and I highly, absolutely recommend all of them. I have managed to read three of them. There are at least five that I found. Conversations with Colonel Corso, UFO, All the Above and Beyond, UFOs, How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light, Connecting the Dots, Exopolitics, Stargates to a New Reality. She has her finger on the pulse of what's going on today, and it takes it way beyond what most of us have found. Happily, the internet gives us more information, but here in the U.S., the material that she has gathered is profoundly amazing. She terms the field, she has renamed her field, and I think it's fabulous. She calls it exopolitics. And that is the study of dealing with the extraterrestrial presence on Earth and its sociological as well as political implications for humanity, something that so many people don't go into. She's an amazing lady. Her interviews are word for word. She doesn't insert her beliefs or her opinions. She gives you the facts, and she allows you to make your own conclusions. And if you have questions, to go research them yourself. She's an amazing woman who has done phenomenal work and is continuing to do it. She has absolutely met the creme de la creme of people in this field and has drawn amazing information from all of them, on top of the fact that she has taken it outside the box into the next step, which is amazing. And on top of reporting on this, she's also had contacts herself as well. So welcome to the show, Paola.
Well, thank you. I don't know what to say. Thank you so much. You're so sweet. That's the most incredible introduction. But, you know, I love it that you're a woman, because we need to support each other. There's so few women in the field. And it's in the field I'm in, especially, it's pretty male dominated. So I support you and everything you do. And it's great to support other women.
Absolutely. I've had a number of women in the field on the show, and I let the men come in too from time to time, but basically, well, women tend to have, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, they take it that one step beyond into the spiritual consciousness and the cosmic consciousnesses, which, you know, are what are, they're not my bread and butter, but that's what I love to do. So how did you get, in one of your books or one of your videos, I think you said that your life has been coincidence or synchronicity after coincidence and synchronicity. clearly you're being manipulated to be in the position you're in. When did you first realize that there was a calling here and you had to follow it?
Well, the thing is, I just realized that now. I have to confess, I've been working for more than 30 years. I'm now 72 years old, and I have, and in the last maybe 5 years, I've realized that somewhere along the line, that you use the word manipulated, I was drafted into the Army. It's like I was drafted to do this work because it just flows so much. I mean, the interviews that I have in my books, it isn't because I sought them out. It's because I was at the right place at the right time, or some idea, or I met somebody or something. And it's like it's been pre-programmed, and it's only the last 5 years since I was in my 60s that I realized this. In the beginning, I was a very nuts and bolts researcher because, in my books, I talk about meeting Dr. J. Allen Hynek after seeing the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1979 and becoming a very close friend of his and working on his Italian translations and driving him around and knowing him from 1979 to 86 when he died. I also became a very close friend of his family's. I know his kids and his wife. And you know, I realized then that I was dealing with, I thought in the beginning that I was just doing a job, but it was nuts and bolts, and it was data collecting. So there was no consciousness, or I didn't care who was inside the craft, or it didn't matter to me, all the other stuff that after all these years I found out about. All I did, and he used to call me, and it was like put pins in a map and see where all the flaps were in the United States, and then I would translate some of the European interviews for him. But in those days, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, that's why I work the way I work. I just do the job and don't make any judgments. And I'm glad that you said that because in the end, you can't put this phenomena in a box.
Oh, God, no. And I would, you know, if I were to sort of explain what happened to you, I would say it was cosmically ordained.
Because but I only know that now. I mean, I just kept doing it and I kept doing it. And the blessing was that in 1994, my dad was Italian. I was born in Italy. I was born in Rome. And my father was Italian consul for the state of Rhode Island. So he was a diplomat and he went back home to his hometown and Italy, he was dying of cancer, of lung cancer, and I decided, I was single, I decided to follow and try to get a job in Rome, and I did. The universe had it when I walked into the American Overseas School, which was the oldest private school in Rome, they made me principal. I mean, I had a master's degree, so they made me principal of that school, and then later I was an English teacher for 15 years, so I started my real serious career in Europe, and so they have a whole different take on how you do research, and they have a whole different take on how conferences are. They don't wear little tin hats, and they don't sell materials, and they don't. And it isn't a commercial venture. It's a very serious academic kind of study. So for 15 years until I came back to the United States in 2007, I was doing work out of Europe, and I just came back from a month in Europe now, and it just gives you another perspective.
Well, their outlook on these visitations that we're getting from extraterrestrials, their philosophy, how they look at it, it's very different from the U.S. I have said often to many people that. At least in the U.S., we're in the dark ages as far as extraterrestrials and the visitors and you know, all of these spiritual things that are going on. We aren't being given any information at all. So we're basically, there was one woman in one of your books that wrote a wonderful comparison as to, people who were chained in a cave and could only look at the wall. And one person finally got unchained and saw that behind them was a bridge and a light and outside, and he saw the world outside, and it was magnificent and it was spectacular. And when he came back in and tried to convince the people who were staring at the wall, the majesty that was beyond them, they didn't want to buy it and they didn't want to listen to it because they hadn't experienced it. And that's what we're like here in the U.S.
You know, it's amazing that you should mention that. You had told me earlier that you had been an educator, and this woman is an educator. The woman you're mentioning is an educator, Lisa Lanyon, and she teaches at Metro Community College here in Denver. And I asked her to contribute something because she's one of the people that had me talk. You know, she had me talk in a community college, and I feel, and this sounds crazy to most people, I feel much better speaking in a university, a college. Here we in Boulder, Colorado, we have lectures at the law school at the University of Colorado. And then I got this story I'll tell you that you'll love. And I feel better speaking there than I do at the entertainment of a UFO conference that's, you know, where all these T-shirts and all this stuff is sold and all this commercialism. And it's just different, and it's surrounded by little alien sculptures and all of this stuff. Because I'm a teacher, it makes it not serious. But the story I wanted to tell you was that when I got my degree here at the University of Colorado, I teach English to high school. I taught English for 30 years, and I taught ancient history in Rome, and I taught photojournalism because I know how to do my own journalistic stories with the, you know, photography and everything. But when I came back in 2007, I was walking in the restaurant part of the University of Colorado, you know, the student center, and my professor, who had become the chancellor of the university, you know, looked at me and he said, what are you into? And I said, well, you know, since I got my English degree, I've done UFO research. And he said, make an appointment with me. And so this is the chancellor. So I, you know, went to see him in his office, and I said, here are my books. I do very good journalistic work, and I've been taught how to do this. He said to me, is this real? And I said, yes, it is. And he said, you know, I'm going to go down to the social studies department and see if there's some way that you could be part of something where you can teach it, or you can, you know, give a lecture to those people. Because the social studies, in not only social studies, but anthropology, psychology, all the social sciences are involved in this. And so I said, just let me know what they say. And he went down and he talked to all those people, and they didn't want to hear it.
No.
So, and the irony is, it was the University of Colorado, which is in 1969. They're the ones that were responsible for saying there's no value to studying UFOs, because the Condon Committee report came out of the University of Colorado. The Air Force had hired Condon to do the studies. And he had all the Blue Book files. I mean, Alan Hynek had given a lot over to that study at the University of Colorado. And I thought, if they would just let me even do a conference here, it would be the end of karma. In other words, they're the one that bashed the whole UFO thing with the Condon Committee report, thousands of pages saying it wasn't worth the study. And yet, if I could open that up again, our karma would be, you know, it goes around, comes around. I have enough here to convince these people that it was worth looking at, because you could do it two ways. You could say it's very interesting sociologically and anthropology-wise. We'd need to rewrite our own history, of course. But most of all, you know, it's very interesting to military because it's a matter of national security. I mean, when missiles get shot down at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 69, that's a matter of national security. When you have all these South American generals that testified at the citizen hearing, that's a matter of national security. They're worried. They are worried about the fact they can't handle these UFOs that come over their bases, and these pilots are seeing them. And at the citizen hearing, there was Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile, Brazil. I mean, all these countries that had these military people, and Steve Bassett's bringing them all to Washington for a hearing, and it was a staged hearing. You know, you could look at this as national security, and I don't know who in the world would laugh at this. This is not funny. It's serious, and it's worth the study, don't you think?
Absolutely. And what gets me is, I mean, we have been able to get down saucers. We have been able to try to reverse engineer them. And certainly we have things like Velcro and closed circuits. And there are many things that we've gotten from the reverse engineering. But at the same time, we're at a place in time, I feel, that the public is okay with knowing that there have been contacts, there have been visitors, and that there are 60 different, you know, cultures, races, kinds of visitors that are here, that and many of them are on the planet as we speak. And to keep us in the dark, not only about the fact that there are so many of the visitors around us, and that interdimensionally phase in and phase out, that we are being cut off from a part of our history and our present and our future, which is just sinful.
Well, you know, you said it so well. My goodness, you really have you have an overall view of the importance of this. So thank you for saying that, because this is no joke. It's not entertainment. It's not to entertain people. It is part of not only our history, but it is part of who we are as a race. I only do, you know, the UFO part and the consciousness part now, but there's a whole study of ancient aliens, or what you call the old history of the planet that you know shows that we've been visited and we've been jump started and we've been and very ancient cultures. All you have to do is travel and you know this, apart from the fact that you can watch Ancient Aliens. But it's all part of the same thing, that it's almost like we're asleep. We don't understand that this is new. It's not old. It's not to be feared. The visitations on the planet, I always make a joke out of this, are not because these peoples are on vacation. These peoples are coming back to see the progress of humanity because the planet initially was seeded by these peoples. And you mentioned 60, but I have a story for you that I just found out about. I am very close with Sergeant Clifford Stone. I'd be glad to talk about his 12 crash retrievals, and I've known him for the last 10 years. I helped publish his book. And both Clifford Stone said 57, Colonel Corso told me 52 different races were categorized in, and here we got this ignorant box of reptilian, Nordic, and grays, and the stupidity of our you know, our categorizing these civilizations into three boxes. And then, you know, where would you put the Virginia case with the little being that was red? It had, you know, reddish skin and so forth in Brazil. I mean, where are you going to shove him? The ignorance that we have of the way we look at these beings, and the whole field is gray alien. Facebook has gray aliens on every page, which is ridiculous. And you know this because you read Colonel Corso's book, and he says what it is.
Yeah.
That it's a clone created in the laboratory, and what they were afraid of was who created these biological entities. He's got in my book, Conversation with Colonel Corso, at the very end, there's even he had seen bodies. He talked about there having four lobes in the brain. They only had one lung. They didn't have any sexual organs. They were created to fly the ship. And he was very clear about that. He worked in the Pentagon. He knew, he had seen bodies. He knew. But going back to the 57, I asked Clifford, I said, how come you said 57? I mean, where did you get that from? And he said, and this is big, He said, Paula, when I was doing crash retrievals, he said, I had a manual that had pages for when we went to a crash, if that being was hurt, what you had to do medically. I said, you had first aid for 57 different beings? And he goes, yes. And I said, you're kidding. He said, well, if you had to do something, you had to know how they were made, where, you know, what how you could, you know, hurt them and so forth. And I said, and you had that in your hand? And he said, yeah, that was a manual that we had on the crash retrievals. And then he added stuff that I knew about because I had heard about it before. But a lot of times they come back and get their own bodies. The beings come back. And he said sometimes we'd leave them there so they would come back and get their bodies. So if there were any crashes, the other cultures that were part of that would try to come back and retrieve their own. And it got, you know, I'm saying things that are so complicated. And he told me details about the crash retrievals and how three of them were in Vietnam. People should get that book, Eyes Only. It's by Sergeant Major Clifford Stone. He's not somebody off the street. He certainly isn't a gossip person. He's on internet. He's somebody who did that work of crash retrieval. He was he signed up for the Army at the age of 16. They already knew that he had had contact. So he was not only an empath, but he was also psychic, and they knew that he could speak to them. Because, you know, we've got this problem of the language and the communication being telepathic. And so because these beings that are coming to all these countries aren't going to school to learn the language. What they're doing, you know, people don't know how complex this is, because you could do a whole class on this. What happens is that they have a direct thought transfer to you if you're speaking Chinese, Italian, and I've done a lot of Italian cases, French, South American. When Antarel speaks to Ricardo Gonzalez, Ricardo says, sometimes he speaks in a language you can't understand. He says, but sometimes he speaks in perfect Castilian Spanish. Perfect Castilian Spanish. It comes through to Ricardo, who speaks Spanish. And if, therefore, the language is ESP, direct thought transfer, why aren't we teaching our children that in school so they can communicate with these visitors in the future when it's okay to talk to them?
Well, you know, that's the one thing that has gotten to me. In the 50s, early 60s, they did a study and they decided that the American public couldn't handle the fact that there were aliens or visitors, and so they were going to protect us. But since then, you know, here we are 70 years later, consciousness has risen. People have awakened. People are very comfortable with their spirituality and their ability to work with their reality as far as creating their own realities. And what makes me so angry is that if they are preventing us from becoming whole by hiding all this from us, because so many people, once they understand what truly is out there, are going to flower. But because they feel that they're different, they're stranger, they're weird, because they have these belief systems, they're cosmically constipated because of it.
I thought like you for many, many years that it was about religion, the Vatican. We couldn't handle it. That's not the reason the secret is being secret. The reason is, if you read Corso's book, the admission that we have this technology, we've gotten this technology from extraterrestrial crashes, from technology that's been downloaded, from all of this, that we have this technology replaces our fossil fuel life. In other words, oil and gas. It crushes our economy totally. It would the fact that we've had free energy since the 1950s, and people need to listen to Dr. Stephen Greer. He knows exactly what he's saying.
Oh, well,
he is
Tesla,
the only one. Yeah.
Tesla gave us free energy in the 1900s, And
right.
in the 50s, we had anti-gravity stuff that would, you're right,
exactly.
absolutely wipe out, you know, the oil companies. And so we've got all this technology, and it's being kept from us for political, financial reasons. And what has killed me, a while ago, I fired the whole government. Just, you know, I put it on Facebook and I said, you work for me, you're not doing what I say, pack your bags and go home, we're going to start again. And I thought I would get, you know, nailed, and nobody commented on it. It was just kind of like, yeah, that's how I feel too. So, you know, when we...
That's beautiful. I love that. It's not about, but this is only one government. I mean, it wouldn't help. Because our government is linked to all the other governments. So, you know, it's like the planet needs to change. We need to change the whole order on this planet. And that needs to change because everybody needs to realize that we are one species, human, no matter what color or religion or whatever. We're a human species. It's just like what Ronald Reagan said, if we would really come together fast if we were threatened by some other, you know, force, we'd all come together. Nobody look at the boundaries or the colors or the religions or anything. As long as the people that rule the planet keep us in separation, and by all this illusion of separation, and you're very spiritual, I can tell, you know, that we're all really one. We are really one species, one energy, one everything. As long as they keep separating at all and making us look at each other as if we're strangers, this isn't going to happen. Because, in other words, the separation is what causes us not to get together as a human species, look out in the cosmos and say, hey, there, you know, you guys up there, we're all one species. You can just come and visit all of us and not have to go to individual governments, which is ridiculous. It's repeating a pattern that is failing.
Oh, yeah. I have always believed, somebody said to me, my late husband was very into the biblical UFOs and everything. And he kept saying, well, they're going to contact the powers that be. And I said, I don't think so. I think they're going to contact the individuals. Because if you contact a government, you may never hear about it. So, but what gets me is, you're absolutely right. We are one family, but not just on this planet. Cosmically speaking, the same source created all of us. So,
right.
So to not understand that while they may look a little different, inside there is that same speck of the creator in them that's inside of us. We have a common ground if we can let go of our fear and find it. And
well, we've been conditioned. The problem is, from birth, we've been conditioned to think like that, and it's going to be our downfall, unfortunately. You know, this isn't the only planet they go to. They go to other planets also. And when you were talking about the you know, the idea that God created all of us and the Force created all of us. I was very close with Monsignor Corrado Balducci of the Vatican, and I not only lectured with him, I used to go to his house. We used to have dinner because I lived in Rome right next to the Vatican. My apartment was on that street. And he said, why would God just create human beings? That would be just such a waste. He said that God created life on all planets, on a lot of planets, and those people are reaching out to us to see how we've progressed. Now, what you can, this is why this should be in a university. What a conversation this is. What if those planets didn't have free will, but they had a cosmic consciousness where when they did for one person benefited everybody, which is a collective consciousness, which is what Christ was talking about when he said, you know, be your brother's keeper, don't do to anybody else what you don't want done to yourself, you know, have a conscience where it's a collective, you do good for those other people because they're going to do good for you. This could be, this particular planet could be an experiment in free will.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and if it is, and remember, we're talking philosophy here. So the UFO phenomenon is just not entertainment. It could get really heavy if you go into this. If this is a planet where they're testing free will, I should think that it's a failure, because it's people kill people, people go after other people, bias, separation, non-understanding, not empathizing, and so forth. Maybe they're watching this experiment to see if it works or not. And in other planets, they have a collective consciousness where they do what's good for all of the people involved, their community. And these are the possibilities. These are conversations I had with Monsignor Balducci. Plus, he said that Christ in the Bible is 66 times he's called King of the Universe, not King of the Earth. So yeah. If he's King of the Universe, that means there's other places he's King of. And so he said, if you do your research, he says, and then he named all the people within the church structure that talks about this, because when people get to a certain level of philosophy or thinking, they know that we're not alone. I knew it because I work with Heineken. He was a scientist. Uh-huh. He was an astronomer. You know, he looked at the skies. He was an astronomer. He used to talk to me all the time about not misidentifying Venus. He'd say, don't say that's a UFO up there, Paul. And I'd say, okay, you know, I got it. You know, you got to study the skies. I got it. So I was lucky. I had the best of the best of teachers. But in the end, I think, and you're verifying this, that this is one of the most interesting philosophical, anthropological, and historical, you know, things that people could talk about with an intelligence, not what's on internet, which I feel is a bunch of, a lot of that stuff is, I called it UFO mythology, but it's like the National Enquirer, like the more conspiracy stuff, the more, you know, crazy stuff, the better it gets. And there's some real facts and there's some real history that makes this subject something to put in a university.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And it's just, to me, when you do even look at the history books, Christopher Columbus saw a ship come out of the water and fly off into the sky. It's in his journals. And, you know, it's a topic that has been out there and has been tickling people's consciousnesses for a very long time. There was a UFO that landed on my campus, and J. Allen Hynek in the 60s came to Michigan to investigate it. And it was one that he validated as real. And when that thing took off and swooped over my dorm, my world changed. It was almost as though that ship radiated love, compassion, friendship. And what was strange was I was just in awe of it. It was like, wow, we're not alone. There's family out there. We got to find them. And then there were others that ran and hid in closets and cried, and then others that stood next to me that didn't even see the ship. So I think
isn't that interesting? See, you brought up a lot of things right now when you said that there are others that didn't see the ship. Sometimes the consciousness of the person is who they're after. In other words, you can have four people and one person sees the ship. And it's that person is meant to see the ship because that person has shifted and that person has something in their consciousness that they can connect to this dimensional world. You know, Jacques Vallée, and people should read his books. Jacques Vallée, who worked with Allan Hynek, he was modeled in the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is a movie that changed my life. François Truffaut played Jacques Vallée. Jacques says that it's about phenomenology. It's a dimensional problem. It's dimensions. When you understand that we are in a dense dimension, we don't see what's around us. We don't understand what's around us. We don't see see what's around us, we're not tuned into what's around us, then it becomes a very complex, the UFO phenomenon becomes very complex. And I'm going to say something else. On the Facebook this morning, somebody wrote on my Facebook, well, I hope science is included in some of these conferences. Look, if the science that we have right now cannot accommodate this phenomenon, you have to create a new science. This is something that Corso kept telling me, and I understood. He said, we need, look, you want to explain it with the science of today? You can't. You must include the paranormal. You must include dimensional phenomena. You must include what Dean Radin is doing with quantum mechanics, you know, entanglement. He's doing the quantum, he's using quantum theory to prove ESP. He's using this new kind of thinking, which includes 360 degrees, not the old science. The old science can't explain this. What do you want to do with the old science?
I think you have to throw in spirituality too, because that's a part of it.
And yeah, and scientists don't do that.
No, they don't.
No, they, you know, they're going, no, that isn't scientific. You know, they, you know, they always go after me. Your conference in Loveland is woo-woo, it's New Age. No, it's not. It's not woo, it's not New Age, and get off that, because you, even Corso, not Corso, Alan Hynek said to me, Paula, you're very concrete, but remember one thing. He said the paranormal is involved with the UFO phenomenon, and he said to me, you can't throw that out. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. He said you've got to include it, because a lot of the people that have been contacted have had paranormal stuff happening to them in their house, in their lives. They're plugged in like you're plugged into an electric socket to a whole other dimension. And how, this is an astronomer scientist that told me this. You want to explain if we're using the old science where you want to go with this? You know, you can't. It's not about the old science proving that UFOs exist. UFOs exist, so you've got to get some other kind of, or you must add some other kind of equation, or some other kind of observation to understand this is real. It's a real, it's probably more real than our old science. Then you need to create another kind of thinking. And John Mack told me this, and you'll get a kick out of this, because John Mack was a very close friend. He was in my apartment in Rome, and we'd have long conversations. And, of course, he's Harvard University psychiatrist who went through hell about this. He said, we need to have a new world view to accommodate this this phenomenon. He said, because when you change your mind, when you grow, when you change your mind, when you think about it a different way, then you'll get it. You can get it.
I would agree with that. Because what, 20 years ago, talking to people about interdimensional anything would have just, they would have given you a blank look. And today, the fact that so much is interdimensional, that some these ships don't travel for light years, they go through wormholes, they go through portals, they shift interdimensionally, and it happens in the blink of an eye or a nanosecond, and to people, it's hard for people to understand this interdimensional stuff, and it seems so logical to me that sometimes dimensions overlap, and that's why you see things that look, you know, like they're in the past or they're in another reality, and they are. And when you look at the crop circles, that's interdimensional coming in, doing it, and getting out, and they freeze time, and they do their designs, and those designs are meant to be symbols that they're not just pretty designs. They're giving us, in my opinion, technology, we just have to decipher it.
Yeah, they're actually also awakening something in the human. They're wake-up calls also. You know, people ask me who I admire in the field, and I always mention Colin Andrews, who lives in Connecticut now, and he wrote a book called The Edge of Reality. I'm going to mention books because people aren't reading them, and they're getting all of their information off internet There's internet trolls that are putting disinformation out there. We've got a mess in ufology. But Colin Andrews' book, The Edge of Reality, and you know he was the crop circle researcher from England, talks about this. He talks about the crop circle, the intricate crop circle designs that a lot of them, just looking at them, awaken something in your DNA. And then he talks about the ones that are the crop circle makers, and we know that there's 60% that are making them. He said even those are consciousness-based because they're getting downloads of what to make. In other words, they're making symbols that awaken consciousness. They're not just making Mickey Mouse. They're making intricate, they're making intricate crop circles. And he, and that book is amazing. People should read it. He says the ones he knew that were doing it would start it at night and it was finished mysteriously in the morning by another force.
Wow.
It was finished. They woke up in the morning and they've got the whole thing there. And they were totally confused because what happened is that force that was downloading them or that was giving them the idea that, in other words, it isn't always the ETs that are doing it. Now, humans are doing it for the ETs. And it's really, and he says it in such a beautiful way because he too is of a certain age, and at his older years he knows this is consciousness based. So like Grant Cameron, who is the other researcher, and Dr. Stephen Greer. I mean, the word consciousness, if you understand that it's a wake up call, it's being awake to everything. Is basically the grad school of ufology. That's why my conference in Laughlin, Nevada, November 10th through 12th, there are 18 speakers, 9 men and 9 women, but the basic is consciousness. I mean, they'll go through all the nuts and bolts stuff, like Clifford Stone is there. He'll go through all the nuts and bolts stuff, the real stuff, the investigative stuff, and I, of course, Colonel Corso is nuts and bolts. It's investigative, and all of that. I'll talk about that. But the bottom line is that these people or these visitors are not on vacation. They're basically here to wake up this planet before it's too late. Then you get really serious about this, to wake up the planet before it's too late, because we belong to something greater.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are a lot of people that have their heads buried in the sand, but when you get enough people and enough energy there, it tends to carry along the other people with it eventually. I mean, I often had said and thought that it wasn't until everybody had their own awakening that this planet would step into another dimension. And I'm kind of altering that slightly, because when enough people have altered their consciousnesses so that, I mean, we can activate our own DNA. We can do unbelievably magical things, but you have to believe that you can do it. And in order to do that, you have to believe in yourself, and you have to touch into that part of the source that's within you, acknowledge it, embrace it, and then live it. And when you start living that spirit that's within, then magic happens and everything changes. It's just amazing.
It is. It's really hard in these times, though. I know people get discouraged because a lot of people are on survival mode. And I've got to be honest with you. My own children don't want to talk about this stuff. They've told me, they said, what does this have to do with my life, Mom? You know, why bother? You know, you're wasting too much time and money, because I'm one of the only field researchers on location in the planet. I don't do any work on the phone. I go and see these people. I go all over the world. I talk to people. And my kids go, well, you could retire in the Bahamas with the money you spent and the time you're wasting on this. And I go, no. I said, it's the most important question for humankind. And they'll answer, well, what does it have to do with the fact that I got to go to work and I got to, you know, pay the bills and, you know, I got to do this. And I can't answer them. So, I mean, there is no answer for that. If you're not there, this is not religion. If you have friends who don't believe like you, you cannot foist it upon them. It is violence. If you believe that you can come back in other lives and there's reincarnation and so forth, then you'll know that the third graders need to go through fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh to get to university. They need to go through those steps. And if they're not there, what are you going to do, push them into university when they're in third grade? It's using that metaphor that I'm using right now, is then your friends or who you hang out with. And I very rarely talk about it with my friends, very rarely. Your friends don't want to know, and it's okay. They're living their life. They're doing what they can do. The kids are living their life. They're doing what they can do. I don't need to convert them. It's not religion. So, but what's interesting is there are people out there that have always wondered about this, and coincidentally or not, and you probably know this because you bump into them at restaurants and everywhere, they always say, what kind of books do you write? And I always say, you don't want to know. they always say, tell us. And I go, well, I do UFO research. Oh, really? You do? Oh, my God, tell me all about it. And I'm shocked that they want to know, because I don't assume that the average person out in the street wants to really get into this. So I'm very surprised a lot of times. And of course, when I do lectures and so forth, I show them all the evidence. I mean, God, I've talked to so many pilots, and I was very close with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, sixth man to walk on the moon. I was invited to his funeral. I was one of the only journalists in the field invited to his funeral. I mean, I knew him very well. And the amazing thing about Edgar Mitchell was, and I got to tell you this because you'll probably remember this story, he told me that he did ESP experiments from the moon. In those days they had the cards, the circle, the square, whatever.
Yeah.
And he said they were 90%, of course NASA didn't know he was doing this. He said they were 90% successful because he had his group in Florida that were getting it at certain times. We're getting the exact what he was projecting. So he came back, and of course he knows thought travels from the moon. I mean, because he was projecting the circle, and mm-hmm. whatever, and they were getting it. And thoughts it can be projected from the moon. Then he went into noetic sciences and tried to use science, quantum physics, because Dean Radin works for ions, to explain what's real, what's really real out there. Because that's the way we do things backwards. What's really real is all this paranormal stuff, and then we need to find a science to explain it.
Absolutely. And that's, it's sort of like the metaphysics and a lot of this stuff with the visitors is it seems strange to people, and it almost seems like science fiction. And yet science fiction is only letting us know exactly what the future holds for us, so that it's just, you see it on television, saw it in Star Trek, the doors that open, walking into a mall, we expect the door to open for us. Every now and then I walk into a door because it is an automatic and it's rather embarrassing.
That's perfect.
The flip phones, the tricorders. I mean, there's so much that Bradbury put into his science fiction show that came to pass. So it's sort of like I get very frustrated when people just seem so blocked that they don't have the capacity to stretch themselves outside the box and just see what the potential for the human spirit is, because it's amazing. I mean, I have a garden that when I moved to this house here 13 years ago, I didn't realize I was built on a gravel pit, and I'm a gardener. And I said, well, then I guess we have to build dirt first. But within a year, I had a garden that looked like it had been there forever. But it was because I talked to the plants. I talked to the little people. I said, I need help here because, this stuff won't grow unless somebody helps it along. And because of the intent, it happened.
There's also a sign that says, do you live in New York?
Connecticut.
Where do you live? Connecticut. Okay. Because Clive, I think it's Clive Baxter, because Ingo Swann hung out with him, because he's the one that did all the work on plants and put electrodes on the plants. and everything, and he tried different music with the plants.
And yelling
there
at
is,
them.
There's science. And that was done in New York. I think his name was Clive Baxter. And it worked. And it worked. Certain music, just like the water thing, like Dr. Is it Moto? Showed that thoughts and water, the words and water, created different kinds of crystals. It's just like thoughts are very important. And Dr. Emoto and Clive Baxter, Emoto did it with water. Baxter did it with plants. You came in and you tapped into a science or a hidden science to create not only the intention, the plant knew it. The plant is alive. Everything's alive. You have to look at the universe being functionally alive, mm-hmm. and then you can act different. You know, as I'm talking to you, I'm realizing I'm not talking about any of the witness testimony or anything like that. You apologize.
Well, we've got another hour. We'll get into that because that's fascinating as well. And I do want to talk about your convention that you have coming up as well. But it's amazing the potential that we have, that we haven't tapped into. And once you tap into it, you break all the barriers and life becomes better. And it doesn't mean you're going to live in a palace. It means that your home is going to become your palace. And it's amazing what we have the capacity for. And because we've been kept so much in the dark about what's going on, and especially with the visitors, because I'm experiencing working with people that are seeing the tall white Nordics that you talk about that are amazing. And of course, you've had contact as well, which is spectacular and had to be mind and life changing as well.
Well, that story I'll tell you about in detail. It was not programmed in that one. I don't know how to begin, except that our field is laden and laced with the little gray alien abduction scenario. And as long as that happens and people are thinking that's the only alien in town, not only is that fear-based, it's not true. There are people here from other planets. Clifford Stone explained to me some of them are living among us, especially in the Nordic countries like Sweden and Norway. Mm-hmm. They are, and I did the Charles Hall case, and they are not Nordics, but they are from, they wouldn't tell Charles where they were from, and that was 1965 off Area 51. It was Indian Springs facility. Charles was a weatherman. And I did his case. It took me 2 years to do that, to fly him out there in that area and have him explain to me. There's 5 books called Millennial Hospitality. These people with their children were guests of the United States government, and what they got in return were the technology transfer. In other words, they got technology, and these people had a 48-hour day, and they lived on the Indian Springs facility, and they were, he thinks they were from Arcturus. He said the people that he dealt with the most was the teacher, the woman that he called the teacher, and the 3 kids that used to come and watch him do the weather with the weather balloons, you know, and the theodolite, and watching the wind and doing all his work. The teacher with these 3 children. And they lived to be about 700 years old. And you can't shove them into just Nordics, because the regular Nordics, like the Nordics, are blonde, blue-eyed. And the people that Ricardo sees are blonde, long blonde hair, and brown-eyed, honey-colored eyes. So we can't, since I've done so much different work, the ones that Charles Hall saw, he said their hair was like almost white, and you could see through it. It was transparent, almost like they had chemotherapy of some kind. But the exchanges that he has with the woman that he calls the teacher in his books is astounding, and it's nothing like I ever researched. I began being interested in the human-type alien phenomenon and wondered why our field was laced with these little gray aliens and reptilians and all this stuff. And I went back to the 1950s and 60s. This is how it started, so I need to tell you this. The book that changed my life was Howard Menger's book, From Outer Space to You. And Howard Menger's wife is still alive. She's in her 90s, and he was from Highbridge, New Jersey, and had contacts with the Venusians from Venus.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break here. It's a hard break, so hold that thought. 5 minutes, okay?
Okay.
Fight it with all that is in it. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
A time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right. You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
This is Nightlight, and if you like what you're hearing, click over to the support page and make a donation to help us keep this amazing station up and running. Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com is totally listener-supported. From the owner, to the host, to the producers, who we can't live without, to the staff, all are working here because we love the work and are dedicated to putting out quality material for all of you. Be it large or small, every donation is greatly appreciated and helps us all keep on supplying information and material to educate and hopefully enlighten you that isn't found elsewhere. Okay, we're back. Paula, I had to rudely interrupt you. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. But, you asked me a question about the contact experience I had in Mount Shasta, and the only way I could explain this so people understand is the research, how it started. And my research started because I had to go back to the 50s and 60s to the giant rock contactees, to Adamski, to Howard Menger, to George Van Tassel. In Italy, it was Eugenio Siracusa, and they all saw Venusians. They saw people from Venus. They described they were from Venus, and that's the typical Nordic. I mean, that would be the typical Nordic. People that were wearing, like, tight suits, bicycle suit, very tight-skinned suit, and people with beautiful faces that had blonde hair and in a lot of cases, blue eyes. And when Adamski had his contact in Desert Center in California, he, Orthon, that came off the ship, actually put his foot down on the dirt, and George Hunt Williamson made a plaster cast of his shoe. So it wasn't like dimensional or anything. It was physical. It was a physical person. And in Van Tassel's case, he had rented that. He had worked for, I think it was Lockheed Martin or one of the aviation places, and he had rented this runway near Landers, California, and this ship landed and walked, and the man came out of the ship and walked over to him, and he had a little I think he and his family had a kind of a little shack near the giant rock, which is a sacred site. It's an Indian sacred site, Native American. And he talked to him, and Van Tassel went public on all the shows. In those days, it was Arthur Godfrey, Jack Parr, those radio shows that maybe you and I remember, other people don't. But he talked about the messages that these space people gave. So they gave these names, space brothers to these people. Howard Menger, the same thing. In Howard Menger's case, there's movies, there's photographs. He befriended these people. They were like regular people. They were, there's pictures of Howard Menger with them that I have in his orchard. And the thing is that the message was the same, that we had to be careful of our nuclear capacity or we would destroy ourselves. In Adamski's case, the person that knew Adamski will be at my conference in Laughlin, Nevada. His name is Glenn Steckling. He's amazing with the stories he tells because he knew him. He was a young child when Adamski was at his house, and Steckling's father was Adamski's best friend. So you're getting it from the source. What they told Adamski, and Adamski was a world traveler. He saw the Queen of Denmark. He went to Pope John the 23rd. He spoke. He went everywhere around the world because that was a part in our timeline where we could have switched our economy to a space economy and gone and met the visitors, or we could keep up the war economy, but we would have to create the wars. So you know where we went. Because then we have to create the wars to have the economy. But the being said, no, if you start doing Star Trek outer space stuff, you can still have money coming from that and economy coming from that because of all the things you create, because of all the spinoffs, because it will generate an economy, and at least you can come halfway and meet us somewhere. You know, I mean, you'll be out in outer space. We made a decision in the 1950s and 60s. That's why we had these human-type aliens visiting. But what happened with the mentality of a military-industrial complex, remember all that stuff that Corso had from Roswell, he had the fiber optics and the transistor and the laser and all this stuff, high-tenacity fibers, went into the military-industrial complex. And Corso says in my book, they were made for war. He says we only were thinking of war. He said we weren't. He said he brought these envelopes of money to these big companies, and he said, you know, develop this thing exactly the way it is, and then use it for the army, the competitive edge of the army. And then he says, you can give it to the people after. That was the secondary thing. And so the deal was that we already had a high economy in the military-industrial complex. We're not about. Unfortunately, that was a choice. We're not about to scrap that and go out into outer space. So, you know, that's economy-wise, that was the message that was given to Adamski, who went all over the world. The same message was given by these Venusians, and I actually interviewed the people in Sicily that were close to Eugenio Siracusa. Some of these people saw the beings walking in his house. In Adamski's case, I saw a photograph of one of them because they used to accompany Adamski. You couldn't tell the difference between the human and the human beings. They were all human-looking. They even wore suits. This was 50s and 60s. So I was wondering what the heck happened that we switched over into this little gray alien abduction scenario, and nobody even talks about the people that came to visit. And I think it's very, very convenient for the managers, and I don't call it government, the managers of this phenomenon to keep people under fear because that's what they think. Then that's what the field becomes. And there was another thing. Those people of the 50s and 60s decided it wasn't worth their while to come back to the United States because the United States was just interested in the craft. The first question was, how does the craft work? How can we use it? What kind of propulsion system? They didn't care about who was inside. They certainly didn't care about what philosophy they had. And they certainly didn't care about the messages because the Giant Rock crowd, and there were thousands of people that went to Giant Rock with the early contactees, thousands in the 50s and 60s, were interested in the spiritual message. So where did these people go? I tried to figure out where they go. If they don't come back here, where are they going? And I found out by studying Sixto Paz Wells' contacts in the Chilca Desert in Peru that they went to South America. They went to Latin America. So then I started, and this was hard. I started interviewing the Latin contactees, and I did that over Skype with an interpreter because they couldn't speak English. So So I had the interpreter there. I asked the questions. I began to, and that's the book that you have that's called All of the Above and Beyond. It's got all the Latin contactees and the fact that these people are still coming off ships, but they're doing it in Latin America. They're not doing it in the States anymore. So I talked to Sisto, and of course the formula is the same. Sisto was into transcendental meditation. Usually it's meditation that starts it. It liberates the mind so the people, the space people, can contact you. And in Sisto and Charlie's case, Veronica Poswell's is Sisto's transgendered brother who was part of this. This with all the people in the 70s that went to the Chilca Desert, that meditated, that fasted, that camped, and then the beings came off and walked up to them. And so one of the people that was involved in that was from Lima, Peru. Peru is a hotbed of these kind of contactees. They've seen these people from other planets. One of the people that was involved was Ricardo Gonzalez, and Ricardo was living in Argentina. So I interviewed him. And he had read my book, and Ricardo is a little different in that Ricardo's mission is more world peace. He knows that unless we unify, we can't have a dialogue with extraterrestrial cultures because they can't do it individually. We have to unify. And so it's Ricardo Gonzalez that's involved with the Nicholas Roich Museum, the peace flag. And for people that don't know who Nicholas Roich was, he was a Russian mystic who lived in India, who designed the first peace flag. It's all white with three red dots for the League of Nations, because Nicholas Roich spent a lot of years in Siberia. He's an artist, and he did 6,000 paintings, 6,000. And he believed that we could create Shambhala, or the ideal community. And he was very much involved with Roosevelt, and they did the Roich Pact, which is that whenever you have a war, you don't go bomb, you know, like cathedrals and museums and Leonardo da Vinci's work and everything. You don't do that. The Roich Pact is famous because what it does is it protects our beautiful artistic history of the planet. And so because he was into world peace, I gravitated towards the work of Ricardo. And Ricardo, in order to get his messages, goes to where Roich goes. He went to Gobi Desert, and he went to Mount Beluka in Siberia, in Altai. And so as I'm doing this and making the book and doing all this, I get this message from Ricardo. He's in the Gobi Desert. He sends me a message. He said, my contact, who is a 10-foot-tall blonde being that he saw physically 8 times, his name is Antarelli, comes from the planet Apu, wants to meet you, and he wants you to be in Shasta. And I thought it was a joke. And so I said, no, there's no way. I don't camp. I'm not going camping. I'm not going freezing to death in some forest with a bunch of people that are speaking a language that I don't understand. Well, they're all Spanish. Everybody speaks Spanish. He speaks Spanish. He does everything in Spanish. So I said, no. And he said, and so he contacted me again a month later from Malaga in Spain, and he said, Paula, he said, Antarel wants you to be there. And so I thought, he said, we'll take care of it. We'll pick you up at the airport. We'll get a tent for you. We'll make sure you're safe and so forth. And so, yeah, no, this is one of those cases where you got to say yes to everything or you don't learn anything. And so I said, okay. And I went there, and it was 3 days of reciting mantras and meditation, saying for about an hour and a half, of looking at the stars. And I had done a lot of this CE5 work with Stephen Greer anyway. I had been with Stephen Greer out in the field. I was part of the movie Sirius. I'm in the film. And I know that if you spend the spiritual time and you call the ships, they will appear. So I was already used to this, and ships would appear, and I'd say, yeah, I know this. I've done this before. This is nice.
Been there, done that.
Milky Way. Yeah, you know, been there, done that. You know, this is really great. But it was hard because in order for me to do this, I had an interpreter that was glued to my arm because she was from Italy, so she was interpreting everything. Because remember, this is all in Spanish. Everything I've done is all in Spanish. And so the very last night, I was starving to death because here's everybody's, you know, doing these mantras and they're just, you know, ingesting juices and water. Because obviously, if you can fast, if you cannot, you know, contaminate your body with food, you're going to be on another vibrational level. I was starving to death. And the last night, all I could think about was food. I can't wait to get out of here so I get some food. And, you know, and we did this very last exercise, and about 11 o'clock, Ricardo comes over and says, Antarel is in the forest. He said, can you handle it? Can you handle this? And I had instantly decide. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I said, okay. He said, I can't go, but two other Spanish women will hold your hand. And you go down there, he said, there's two other people there. So this was seen by seven people. There was three other people there. So it was seen by seven people. I wasn't the only one. But he said, hold your hand. You cannot use a flashlight. You have to walk down the hill, and you have to stand in front of the trees at the bottom of this hill because he's standing there. And so I'm going, okay, well, you know, as long as I'm holding somebody's hand, I'm going to be okay. And he goes, no, he said, but when you get there, you're going to see a mist come out of the ground, he said, and you stand in that mist and you let go of the person's hand because you're all going to have different experience. All of you are going to have a different experience. And he couldn't come. So I went down there with three women and saw this carpety mist come out of the ground. I stood there. I let go of Mercedes' hand, and I looked in front of me, and against a tree is this 10-foot tall. I saw him this way. I saw him as he had a hood on, hoodie. He had a hoodie like it came out of a gym, and he had fine features, and he had a hoodie and two-piece suit. He had tight pants, but it was like a hoodie with a blue, you know, jacket. And he was very tall, very, 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 from the minute I saw him, he was talking. I mean, it wasn't in my head. I could hear it echo through the whole forest. The other two women didn't hear that. And I'm going, but he was talking. It echoed through the whole forest. I could hear it. I mean, but it was in a language I couldn't understand. I didn't know what he was doing because it was not Spanish. I just heard Spanish. I found out later that Antarel speaks Irdin, I-R-D-I-N, and Ricardo's girlfriend sings in that language. It's an ancient language. However, I'm there listening to this saying, what is he saying? But I was terrified. I will tell you that contact is terrifying because I had no protocols. I was never told what to do. I didn't know what to deal with. I knew that person wasn't a human person, and it is not easy because you don't know what to do. So I just looked at him, and in my mind said, I respect you, Antarel. That's all I could say because I don't know what to say, you know, basically because I didn't know what to do. Nobody ever told you, you know, it's not easy. And so he's there, and he, at the very end of this constant dialogue, it sounded like he had a bullhorn, he said in English, perfect English, but it was robotic. He said, thank you. And then he turned around and walked back into the forest. And he turned right around and walked right back. And I looked at everybody to say, did you hear that? Did you hear? Am I crazy? Did he say thank you? Am I nuts? How could I make that up? And so when we ran back up the hill to tell Ricardo, he said, what happened? I said, I think he said thank you. I don't know what else. That's what I heard in English. Mm-hmm. The rest, I didn't understand a word. I did not understand a word. And after that encounter, and I was willing to go public with that, but, you know, I'm understanding it now because he comes from Apu. The book is Contact from Apu. It's in English. People can buy it. The Apunians have been involved with the Peruvians for hundreds of years. And the towns in Peru have seen the Apunians. They've walked among the people, and they have a history of predicting earthquakes, of healing people, and so forth. The people from Apu. Now, where's Apu? It's in the constellation of Alpha Centauri. It's the planet they just found. It's 4 light years away. And the guy I saw was perfectly human. It's just that he was a little too tall. He was 10 feet tall. And was it easy? It was terrifying. It was like I had post-traumatic stress. And was there anything wrong with him? No. It's just clash of cultures. It's a clash of cultures. It's looking at something like a ghost that you look at, you know it's a ghost, but you can't understand it because it's a ghost. I explain to people, but it changed my life because the reason why the Apunians are with Ricardo is for us to achieve. They're time travelers. They know what's going to happen to the Earth because they've seen it, and they say we can change it. So they want people to get an awareness of what the problem is. And they said we're in emergency mode. And if you read the book, Contact from Apu, it will tell you that we can change the timeline by changing our actions. They don't want to see us go down that road. They want us to jump timelines. And so I said to Ricardo, all I can do, I'm still going to do my work. I'm still going to do the nuts and bolts stuff. But what I can do is meditate and be present at these gatherings so I'm part of the collective consciousness. I'm part of the critical mass. I can't just write the story. I have to be part of the critical mass. So I went to Chile with him in September, where he disappeared for 1 hour and got messages in the Atacama Desert from these people. So that's in my book, The Messages from Atacama. And because they're telling him about what's happening in the future. And just to make the, if people want to know, they can go to my website, the latest message that we got in Spain, and I went to Spain for that reason, is on the website, www.paolaharris.com. It was given to Ricardo by a woman named Evika that's regular size. She's on a ship, and she is a mixture of human and Apunian, and she has made some statements that have to do with Stephen Hawking's prediction that we need to evacuate the planet in 100 years. That's why all this push and shove to go to Mars, because the people that want to save themselves think they're going to go to Mars and it's going to do it. But Stephen Hawking made that statement, and Evika, who is the being, mentioned to Ricardo about scientists that are making these statements. And so am I following this work? Yes. But also we had talked about this before. I'm also modeling it in that I have to do the meditation. I have to do the raising of the vibration work with these people. It's very difficult because it's all in Spanish all the time. So I always have to have an interpreter glued to me because I don't know what anybody's saying.
I was just wondering if there's a part of you that on a consciousness level understood what he said, that there was a knowingness, even though you couldn't intellectually understand the language, but was there a knowingness as to somehow the meat of what he was saying to you?
Well, can I ask you, are you psychic? Are you a practicing psychic?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't talked about that. They dragged me back a year later, and it was even worse because they dragged me back, and Katla came with me this time into Shasta because he said they had told me something and they needed to know what it was, and it was encrypted, and it had to come out of my brain. Mm-hmm. And so he said, I'll go with you this time, he said. And this was 7 people, including my interpreter, Julio Palacio from California, who saw the whole thing. This time, a tube came down from the sky, and Antarel was with 2 other guys. They were wearing white suits, white bicycle-type suits. I only saw them from the waist up, and it was a holographic image, but I saw all 3 of them. They all looked alike, except I could tell which one Antarel was, because he wasn't playing games. He was his face was very, like, wake up, I'm trying to communicate with you type thing. And I had I'll be honest with you, I had post-traumatic stress. I was shaking. I was sweating. Ricardo told me to calm down. He said, they're telling you to calm down or they can't talk to you. And I couldn't do it. I could not calm down. I was I kept looking at them because they came down. It was like a light came down from the sky. It was like a tube, and they were like holographs because I could see through them through the trees. Mm-hmm. And I know Antonella was not happy because he turned around and gave me a look when they went back up again. And then at that night at the hotel in Reno, Nevada, because I drove there at the last minute. It's a long process how I got there because they told me I had to go. They told me while I was swimming, you go back to Shasta. The message was, this is the message. It's a one-liner. Because I found that the beings that come, the human-type space brothers, are very curt. They're one-liners. They're here for a reason. They don't embellish anything. The message was, they woke me up at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock with one message. If you will lead, we will match your efforts. That was the message. So I called Ricardo right away. I said I was so embarrassed I couldn't get the message because I was so nervous because even though Ricardo was holding my hands and everything, I was shaking. I said, this is the message. And they gave it to me in my sleep because I'm a mess. So I can't get used to it. So basically the sentence was one. It was at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. They woke me up with this sentence. If you will lead, we will match your efforts. In other words, you, humanity, the universal you, if you people want help, we will match your efforts. But if you don't make an effort, we'll just turn around and go home.
Uh-huh.
That was it. And Ricardo said, this is what they told you. And I said, yep. So that puts a huge responsibility on me to do the work seriously, to do it well, to be part of the collective consciousness, which means meditation, going to these places, whether I go with Stephen Greer doing the CE5s, we do the same thing. We still meditate. We still put out the intention. Or whether I go with Ricardo or whether I go with other people, it's important that we project our thoughts that we really would like some help, that we are, you know, that we do really want to connect with the consciousness. So as a result, I've brought Ricardo Gonzalez twice to Laughlin, Nevada. I'm bringing Sisto Paz Wells and Enrique Villanueva this year, the people from Peru that really are getting these messages. Enrique lives in California, and he speaks English, so it'll be easier. But I'm bringing these contactees, plus Haktan Octagon from Turkey, Jaime Malsan from Mexico, and you know the story on the mummies they found. And that will be in Laughlin, Nevada, November 10th through 12th. All these international people so that the Americans can have access to them so they can hear this information. So that and I don't have pictures of little gray aliens anywhere. I don't have any little gray alien statues where you pose. It's all the Hubble telescope photos. All the beautiful, you know, nebulae and everything. Everything is done very seriously. It's a lot of fun, though, because we are going to have a visionary of Coast to Coast who will question Clifford Stone on the stage. And for the people that are interested in changing the paradigm in conferences, it's www.starworksusa.com. And on a personal level, I'll answer questions anything they want to know about, even the contact situation. Ricardo got a standing ovation last year. Of course, he speaks Spanish, so I have to get an interpreter for the people that come from.
That was going to be my question.
No, well, it's hard. It's expensive. It's hard to bring people from other countries. Last year, I had 9 international speakers, 3 from Italy, 1 from Denmark, 1 from Australia, and Ricardo and Jaime from South America. Now, in order for you to get the whole picture of what's going on in the world with UFOs, I've got to do that. I mean, you can't just get it from 4 people that you know speak everywhere. And that is one of the problems, and I'm going to be honest with you, is nobody looks at anybody else's research, so nobody has the whole picture. The good thing about us is that we're educators, so we read everything. I have read everybody's book. The newest books that have come out, I've already read them. I've studied everything that's come out that is not my research so that I can try to make this an academic type study. So I have four more books to read, Grant Cameron's Managing Magic and Inspired. I've got a book on the Amigizia case in Italy to finish. So what you're getting when you get international speakers in a conference like this is you're getting the whole 360 of the world, of what's happening in the world, because I'm interested in that.
But that's important, and it's especially important, you know, that you're doing it in the United States so that people can have the opportunity to hear these different perspectives, and because they haven't had opportunity to do that. I mean, I know you've had the conference, but for the most part, you know, it's MUFON, and there's nothing wrong with MUFON, but their conferences are more of a circus. And
well, also the International UFO Conference in Phoenix, which was the Laughlin Conference, has gone, but it's the same people. I love those people down there, but they're the ones that bought it from Bob Brown. So what I've had to do in order to change a paradigm, I've gone back to the old place, but it was my company, Starworks USA. And let me say that it's all come out of my pocket. I've had to mortgage my apartment. I've had to borrow money to do this. This, I have no sponsors. I have no people that are really paying for this. And people are getting used to it because the bottom line, the university of this is consciousness. So Grant Cameron will get up there and talk about presidential UFO and all his nuts and bolts stuff, but he goes to consciousness. He will finish the conference talking about consciousness, and so will everybody else because they're all on that path. So if I have enough people that are on that path, then what's going to happen is we can make this paradigm shift.
Uh-huh.
I mean, do you believe that? I think I believe that.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think that consciousness is where it all lays. And if you can get people to wake up, that's you know, you've got the battle won just about. And it seems to me that especially in the United States, there are people that are waking up and they don't know what to do with it. They're so confused. They have no idea as to what the universal laws are or any of this cosmic material that has been, you know, it's out there. It's a matter of reach for it. And I think what is befuddling to me so often is that old adage of, you know, the answers are inside yourself. Look for them there. There's an amazing story about how when humanity was created, they were created, you know, in the image of, they thought at the time, the gods. And they created humanity, and then they realized that they had created humanity as powerful as they were, and they were a little reluctant to let us loose on the cosmos. And so they said, look, we're going to have to hide from humanity the knowledge that they are powerful and one with us until they are strong enough to find to utilize those powers wisely. And they argued for eons as to where they were going to hide this knowledge. And, you know, the moon was, they would get there, the deepest sea, they would get there. And finally, an old crone wandered in and took a look at them all and said, look, I'll tell you where you can hide it so you can get this show on the road, basically. She said, hide it inside of him. He'll never look there.
I love that story.
And so it was done.
I love that story. Yeah, I love that story. Well, they listen to you. You've got the key to how to do this.
Well, but you know, your material is so wonderful. I could flow into your material so beautifully because, I mean, my gosh, Roswell and Colonel Corso and Stanton Friedman was very, very important to a lot of the Roswell material getting out as well.
Yeah, he was. He is a hero. He is a hero because that's how we started with Roswell. But I've been to Roswell like seven times, and I did interview, Glenn Dennis, the mortician, and all those people. That's the nuts and bolts stuff. the documents and the oh my God, we got so much data. I don't know what other, the sightings, the documents, all that stuff. We got so much of that. I don't know. People say to me, don't you want disclosure? I say, it's already there. You're not looking. You don't need the President of the United States to say it's real. Just go look at the British release documents. I was in Ireland when they released the documents from Ireland. Countries have released documents, real stuff. And then, you know, if you want to read my books, they're all interviews from the real people that are, you know, some are alive. So disclosures happened. You don't need the president to tell you that UFOs are real and we've been visited and this is part of an ancient history. The problem is this, and I don't know if you agree with me, because this is revolutionary. The secret is being kept by the people, not by governments. Because the people, when you wake up, like what happened to me, and they say, if you will lead, we will match your efforts. You've got the responsibility of the world on your shoulders. And people don't want to turn their world upside down. They want to watch the Super Bowl. They want to have a couple of beers. Like my kids, I mean, the same thing. They don't want to think about this because it turns you upside down and backwards. And it changes your life. For the people that I know that have been involved, it causes their marriage to go down the tubes. It changes their lives. They feel obsessed. It's so revolutionary if you really digest this. And ideally, it would be revolutionary enough for us to change a whole society. That a lot of people say, I prefer to think of it as science fiction. It's fun. Let's go on internet. Let's go hear these people. This is fun. This is, you know, let's make statues. Let's put a T-shirt on. Let's, you know, they'd rather stay in that area because the responsibility of knowing is so heavy. I mean, I found it that way. It's a very lonely existence.
Yes, but everybody who gets to that place has a different, just a slightly different perspective. And when you put it all together, you have this wonderful mosaic of all of these different levels and slants of perspective on the fact that we are totally responsible for ourselves. And that's, I think, the big thing is most people don't want to be responsible. They want to be able to blame somebody or say, you know, and so it's like, you know, just has my life from time to time been in a mess? Of course it has. And I did it and I did a great job. But, you know, it's kind of like, okay, let's clean it up. Let's take responsibility for this. And, you know, I don't want to in any way say that religion is not a good thing because it means everything to a lot of people. But if you take that next step of spirit into spirituality, where you take responsibility, where you are the one that can either make or break whatever your future is, and you live that and you walk it, then, you know, while the journey may have been a rough one, and it is for all of us, what you get at the end is so amazing. And I'm really lucky. I'm 73 years old. And frankly, I have an amazing life and I love it. But, you know, it's because I've chosen this. And do I blame people every now and then? Absolutely. You know, if I were perfect, I wouldn't be here. You know, I'd be somewhere else causing trouble, but it's an amazing experience, and I probably would have been frightened too. But who was it? Oh, you told it was John Lennon who saw a UFO out of his apartment window, and he kept yelling, come back, you forgot me. And now he would have gone voluntarily. I'm not sure I would.
Well, no, that was one of my fears because I had read Ricardo's story. If you read Contact from Apu, and it's Ricardo Gonzalez. I had his book translated into English and released it last year. That Ricardo is very nervous when he has to have the contact. And one of the stories he told me was that one of the contacts, he was supposed to go aboard ship, but he was so nervous he went into the forest in Shasta. And he saw these little children playing, and he said, how could they be out at 11 o'clock at night? Where are their parents? And they were playing hide and seek, and they were running around. And while he was concentrating on these kids, they took him aboard ship, and he found himself aboard the ship. And Antarel said to him, you were so nervous that we had to create a distraction, and it was a hologram that you were looking at of these kids. And he goes, so Ricardo looks at Antarel, who's physical, and he says, then you must be a hologram. And Antarel bends over, takes his finger and shoves it into Ricardo's chest and said, I am not a hologram. I am physical. And so I remembered that story, and as I was in chest, I was going, oh, no, I'm not going aboard ship. I'm not going aboard ship. So so they looked at me and they said, you silly person, we can't talk to you because you are reacting like this. So you're going to go to sleep, and we have to give you the message while you're sleeping. And that's what they ended up doing. They're very nice. They gave it to me in a way I could accept it, which was the one sentence deal when I'm sleeping, but it was such a powerful sentence. But that's okay for me. I don't know if I'd want to wish it for my kids or the baker down the street or, you know, because I had done all the homework. I've done all the work. I mean, I couldn't have done more work. I'm leaving all the work behind that. You know, there is no money and there is no real anything in ufology. I basically have had to finance everything on my own and a great sacrifice. So what I'm leaving behind in these five books is the real stories of the military, of people like Corso and Edgar Mitchell and Paul Hellyer, the defense minister, and all the people I interviewed, the very top-level people. And then maybe let's wish that 200 to 300 years from now, this becomes fact. And they'll go into the universities and they will look up the exact words of the pioneers, and I will have done that work. That is basically all I hope to get out of any of this.
Well, 100 years ago, the Wright brothers flew, and now we're talking space travel and interdimensional stuff. And so I would say that your foundation that you have provided for people to step on to gain a better awareness of the journey that we're actually on is going to be, I would imagine people are standing on it already, and it's just a shame that, you know, there's not a counter or something so you can see how many people have benefited from the work that you've done, because it's amazing. But I, you know, it feels as though you just, there was a drive in you that you know, ADHD for sure, you know, which I think is a good thing, by the way. It feels as though you have been compelled to do this, and you didn't really need to get into a ship because you had already experienced the consciousness rising. So I would think that a lot of people that go into the ships and everything are people that need to be convinced it's real. You knew it was real already.
No, I knew it was real, and I just need some time. It's really funny. I'll tell you another little story. This will make you laugh, but I was so embarrassed by the way I acted in 2015. And I've been apologizing to Ricardo ever since. I mean, people don't understand. It's not that easy, especially when you're in the forest, you can't use a flashlight. It's dark. And you're having these experiences. You're watching these three guys that look the same, in the trees. You can see the trees through them and so forth. And you want to calm down, but you can't. And so what I ended up doing is I ended up going to Crestone, Colorado, and I got a message. I go to Crestone a lot. That's where the movie Sirius was shot, and that's where Dr. Greer took us all. And I got a message that I had to go to Devil's Tower, Wyoming. That was in the movie Close Encounters. That started my whole career. That started my whole entire career. So I didn't want to go alone, so I asked some friends from Boulder. I said, can you come with me? I got this message. I got to go there. And I went to see Devil's Tower, and I did the whole walk around it. It's like 2 miles. It was gorgeous. It was just like a movie. And at night, the park rangers were doing a Skywatch thing, and they had this amphitheater. And as I'm sitting there, and they're pointing out different stars, I said, Paula, you're going to get up and you're going to walk in the forest by yourself. You've got to get over this fear. This is stupid. You're embarrassed. That should never have happened. You should have let them talk to you. So I got up. I walked down off the bleachers. My friends didn't see me, and I started walking in the forest under Devil's Tower. Can you imagine? Under Devil's Tower, there's this tall forest like Shasta. So I'm walking around over there, and I'm going, I feel good. You know, I'm not scared. I feel great. This is wonderful. I feel wonderful. Oh, I got over this fear. And my friend who saw me go, she came running into the forest to find me. And she said, Paula, what are you doing in here? And she grabs me by the arm. And what I hear and she heard was, da-da-da-da-da, the music from Devil. I said, are you hearing that? She said, yeah, but there must be some tourists around that have a radio. And we heard it again, and we heard it again. And I'm going, no, there could be tourists around, Julia. But when you grab my arm, that music came out in the forest. You can hear it. I can hear it. We both hear it. It's in the forest. It's under Devil's Tower. And it's like the completion of the getting over of the fear. And it was like, I'm not kidding you, the music was there. It was so loud. It was from the movie. And maybe there were tourists that were playing it or something, but it was a forest, so I didn't see other people. I never saw anybody else. But that is a great story, because that's a paranormal event that I think I'm over my fear. I don't know. I don't want too much to happen in the future, but, you know, that was something that I went back to because my career started with that movie. So I loved you ought to go there sometime. It's amazing.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I think one of the nice things that this brings up is that they actually have a great sense of humor too. And my favorite line from that movie was, you know, you have to let him go. They were invited. And I do believe, I do really believe that some people feel invited and they're comfortable with all of this. And those are the ones that get to go outside the box. And you know, if you feel like, if you yearn to know more about it and you really want to get to know them, then someplace in your DNA and your consciousness has been planted that seed that you were invited to know this.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's funny you should say that because when I knew I was invited because I refused the invitation to Shasta three times, and I knew I was invited. When he said thank you, I knew that's what that was about. I got it. I got it after 30 years when he said thank you. I knew it was about Close Encounters. I knew that right away. I said, I think he did it because of Close Encounters, because I was invited, you know. And the secret I tell everybody when I do a lecture, I say yes to everything. Say yes. Go ahead. Say, if you get invited or somebody says, do you want to go there? And you say, oh, I don't know. You just say yes. Say yes. Because the yes part is what brings you to the other level.
Well, yeah, it means you're accepting. You're willing to be exposed to things that you don't understand, but you're willing to learn. And I think that's one of the coolest things about getting older. So long as your brain stays active, you're young, and there's always something new that is, you know, that comes into your reality. And you mentioned Nicholas Roerich a while back, and his museum in New York City is the most inspiring thing I have ever seen. He painted with tempera, which means that he had his canvases rolled up on mules and the powder in packs, and he had to melt snow in order to make his paint, to paint these paintings. And when you look at them and you realize that they have been traipsed all over, you know, India and all of the places that he went, it's magical. And he and his wife were together part of the creation of the Theosophical Society. So
right, exactly, yes.
So that there's go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm so glad you know about that, because that people say, well, why aren't you, you know, going with other contactees? Why don't you do their stories and so forth? I'm interested in world peace, and Ricardo Gonzalez, all his work is on world peace, all of it. When we were in Spain just now, Alicia Rodriguez, who won the Nobel Prize for Peace, who is part of the Nicolas Roig Museum, she's from Spain, but lives, I think, in South America. She is the woman that is the main Roig person and brings the flag everywhere and to the United Nations and everywhere. And for people that don't know, those three red dots are the Chintamani stones, which were given to us by extraterrestrials.
Yeah, well.
There's an extraterrestrial connection with Nicolas Roig. The reason I admire Ricardo and do more with him is because of world peace, not because of UFOs or aliens or any of that. You can't go wrong when you're dealing with world peace.
No, and they actually yelled at me at the museum because I had to touch the paintings just to feel the energy, just to feel what, you know, knowing how they were created and the mystical, spiritual aspects that were painted into them are just phenomenal. And you know, they've been used in as illustrations in a lot of books and stuff like that. I think people, if they Google him and they look at his artwork, they'll recognize it. It's been all over the place, and it's amazing stuff. He was a magical man. He looked a little
well. Also,
weird.
He did 6,000 paintings. There's a DVD on him. 6,000. That's a lot of paintings.
Well, and he created the costumes and the sets for the Russian ballet too.
Yes, yes, yes.
So that he was multi-talented.
The thing that interests me, like, and people don't know this, Billy Meyer went to India and he had his first sightings in India. Adamski went to India and was involved with India. Adamski in the early days went to India. India and the Eastern thought is very important to the UFO connections.
Absolutely. Oh, geez. We're out of time. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so very, very much for being here tonight.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Barb.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Barbara DeLong, host of Nightlight Radio, inviting you to join me on a cosmic journey, exploring a metaphysical montage of spiritual material, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between, including spiritual readings for those who seek enlightenment. Let Nightlight provide you with equal measure of light, love and laughter, insight, wisdom, and inspiration. Monday nights, 10 to 12 p.m. Eastern, right here on Studio B, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.